On July 25th, the whistleblowing website WikiLeaks released more than 75,000 classified documents related to America's ongoing war in Afghanistan and caused a sensation, resulting in weeks of press coverage. On October 22nd, WikiLeaks released some 400,000 documents related to the war in Iraq, and at least in the United States, was pretty much a one-day wonder. The New York Times offered a comprehensive overview of the data on the day of its release. According to its public editor, Arthur Brisbane, the Times took a reputational risk in doing business with WikiLeaks, but, quote, inoculated itself somewhat by reporting independently on the organization. What the Times did, along with reporting on the data, was to report on the instability of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. All in all, in the U.S., the leak was merely a ripple in the torrent of U.S. election coverage. However, according to Gavin McFadgen, director of the Center for Investigative Journalism and a visiting professor at City University in London, the leak made a big splash globally because it was full of big news.
These documents show that there were 15,000 new, previously unacknowledged civilian deaths. There were 681 civilians killed at checkpoints. There was also 17 new killings associated with Blackwater.
One element of the story that did get a fair amount of play here was the degree to which the U.S. military turned a blind eye to abuses or atrocities committed by the Iraqis. What hasn't gotten a whole lot of attention is how that revelation played in Iraq.
A small minority of political groupings and small presses dealt with that issue. But the main political groupings were much more interested in the evidence of U.S. killing of civilians. They all talked about it as an example of how the United States probably didn't belong there anymore. There was something else which didn't get a lot of coverage in Iraq, and that was in Abu Ghraib itself. In 2009, there were 112 new cases of abuse. You could see there'd be many reasons why the Iraqi authorities would not be keen on a lot of that information, though they were certainly very keen on the notion of the killing of civilians by U.S. forces.
Some of the documents suggested that these abuses went right to the office of Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki, who was said to have directed a counterterrorism unit that targeted Sunni areas. What was the government's response to the revelation?
The initial response was disbelief and denying the credibility of the sources, and they were never discussed in a way in which action in any form could be taken to stop this stuff.
The coverage in the New York Times of the latest release was quite substantial. It was page one with a whole mess of sidebars going kind of point by point through the list of appalling revelations. And then the story kind of petered out. Did it peter out in Europe as well?
No. The Guardian has had pieces every day, often front page pieces. Le Monde, I know, has done the same thing. Spiegel has had a smaller number because they're a weekly publication, but they're still doing it. And I think the Swedish and Dutch newspapers have had really substantial coverage starting this week.
Why do you suppose that it did not get traction in the States but has continued to hold the imagination of audiences beyond our borders?
There have been major events on the press here, but it hasn't stopped at least The Guardian and Le Monde from continually reporting the event. As the WikiLeaks story developed, Margaret Thatcher was in the hospital. And there was a lot of worry that if she died in the middle of this, there'd be no coverage at all. The Guardian has consistently been publishing almost daily every new event, every bit of new analysis, and that in itself creates the traction.
This raises an interesting philosophical question. At what point does it become the duty of a news organization to hang on to a story, even if it believes that the public is uninterested, bored, and unprovoked by the revelations?
On the whole, if you felt a story, for example, was of enormous consequence, it would be quite wrong not to run it until people understood what was involved in it. One of the classic cases in British journalism was the thalidomide scandal. That story ran week after week after week on the front page of the Sunday Times. And though it didn't have any initial traction, by the end of the 12th week, it had enormous traction. And I think that tended to be a model by which we tended to work here. On television, the same thing. I made programs, for example, about asbestosis and how it affected miners and the working population. One program didn't do it. We had to make 7 programs over 4 months. And that had the effect. We got the laws changed. If you care strongly enough about something, if you feel there's a powerful moral purpose in pursuing it, then you'll pursue it.
Gavin, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Gavin McFadgen is the director of the Center for Investigative Journalism at City College of London. So why was domestic coverage of WikiLeaks so thin? We asked Clint Hendler of the Columbia Journalism Review.
The Afghanistan logs were about a war which we're still very much having a policy debate over, and attention's a lot more focused there. It doesn't surprise that when the documents come out now that they didn't get as much coverage as the Afghanistan ones.
The Afghanistan story was kind of two stories, right? It was about what was revealed in the documents, but a lot of it was about the unauthorized leak itself, no?
WikiLeaks, you know, has been knocking around as an organization for a few years. You know, they made a big splash with the release of a helicopter video that showed the death of 2 Reuters employees at the hands of U.S. forces that the Pentagon had declined to release despite Freedom of Information Act requests. But after that, their next big thing that really shook things up and drew attention in America were these Afghanistan logs. And here you had the largest leak of undisclosed information in history. And we had to talk about who WikiLeaks was, who Julian Assange was, what the law was about this, where these documents might have come from, what the impact would be on the course of the war. With the Iraq documents, in many ways, we already had our discussions and our debates about some of the most important issues raised by the leak itself.
Something else that seems to have kind of corrupted the news ecosystem here is the focus on Julian Assange himself. He's under investigation for possible sexual assault by the Swedish government. He has seen a lot of internal strife in his own organization.
There have been, you know, some high-profile defections from the organization. There are lots of stories that center around the operations of WikiLeaks that actually have an impact on the effectiveness and stability of the organization. And those strike me as worth covering. At the same time, is the exact right time to do that, the day when the organization does release important documents that tell us something about these very important foreign policy questions? I definitely think there is a time and a place for it and an amount of space for it, and I'm not sure that we're always getting it right.
What underlies all these questions I'm asking you is, where's the follow-up on the fairly significant stories that were at least hinted at by the release of this huge trove of documents?
Considering that many of the documents spoke to things that newspapers had already spent a lot of time talking about, maybe this coverage that it got, as flawed as it may have been, was follow-up to things that we wrote about 3 or 4 years ago. We just went through a major election. We spent months and months talking about the greatest issues facing the nation. I don't remember hearing about Iraq. It's sad. The war's still happening. There are still soldiers dying, and Iraq is still suffering from the repercussions of it. But it's not the story it once was.
Clint, thank you.
You're welcome, Bob. Thanks for having me.
Clint Hendler is a staff writer for the Columbia Journalism Review.
This is On the Media.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.